The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters Today. My name is Bob McChesney. I'm your host here on WILL 580 for Media Matters. Traditionally on Media Matters, over the first couple months of the program's history, we focused on the United States, looking at the media there, the communication systems here, and its effect on politics and culture and society. Today we're going to make a bit of a change, and we're going to look at China, the largest and most populous country in the world, and a country that is at the center of any discussion of what's going to happen to our species in the next century or the foreseeable future. We're very privileged on Media Matters today to have two terrific guests to talk about China. Visiting us from Vancouver, British Columbia, in Canada, from Simon Fraser University, is Professor Yuzi Zhao, who is arguably the leading expert on Chinese media, certainly in the English-speaking world, in North America, arguably in the entire world, a first-tier scholar of how media and communication work in China today. Accompanying her in the studio, another guest, a privilege to have in the studio, is Professor Dan Schiller from our own University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, as well as the Institute of Communications Research, a colleague of mine there. And Dan is an expert at international media communication and telecommunication, and recently returned from a trip to China. This is a pre-recorded show. We did it when Professor Zhao was in town visiting, giving a guest lecture, so we won't be taking calls today. Please bear with us. We'll be back to a live program next week or in the very near future. Professor Zhao, your book, your most famous book, was published, in fact, by University of Illinois Press, Media, Markets, and Democracy, Between the Party Line and the Bottom Line. What was the basic thesis of your book, if I could just start right there?
Well, the basic thesis of the book is that the Chinese media is in a situation where party control and market control coexisted. So you have a situation where what you have is a fusion of party control and the market influence.
You know, just at that point, it becomes clear that when you talk about media in China, you're talking about party control, the Communist Party, you're talking about markets and capitalism, that suddenly to understand media, you've got to have a much bigger picture of what's going on in China, maybe the world, that there are changes taking place that you write about in your book that would have been unthinkable 25 years ago in China, maybe unthinkable anywhere in the world, but certainly in a country that's been a communist nation since 1949. That has been a rigorously communist nation, and now it's been undergoing a tremendous sort of change, a sea change almost, in its political economy. What have been some of the major changes that have taken place in China, say, since the 1970s?
The kind of media system won't be possible without the economic reforms that started in the late 70s, specifically Deng's economic reforms. So on the one hand, you have in terms of political structure, still tightly controlled the political system. At the same time, basically the party state unleashed the market. And the idea is that through economic reforms and through integration with global capitalism, China will be able to so-called catch up with the West. Mm-hmm. And so on the one hand, the party really still maintains tight political control, and 1989 is a pivotal moment where the party basically reassert political control. At the same time, the party is unleashing market forces and basically tell the media systems and the whole country, say, just plunge into the sea of commercialization, into the sea of economic growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Dan Schiller, you know, you like myself, you're an American. You've been watching China in our news media and in our political culture. You and I are roughly the same age. And there seems to have been a real shift in how the media covers China in the United States from, say, the 1960s to today. Has that been your experience as well?
Well, yes, Bob. I think that there's been a shift because the media is registering in the United States the fact of fundamental political transformation of the very sort that Professor Zhao has just mentioned. And the U.S. media can't and wouldn't want to be oblivious to those kinds of changes. They see China as the most tantalizing market possibility, not only for the rest of the business system, but for some of their own parent companies, find it irresistible to contemplate further involvement in that market. At the same time, there remains a very significant wariness because of the historical animosities between U.S. elites and the Chinese in the context of the earlier shift towards socialism there.
China's always seemed to confuse the American elites, at least in our lifetime, because I remember in the 1960s growing up, I'm 49, growing up at a very early age, China was held out as, you know, this evil empire connected to the Soviet Union, part of the domino effect that was spilling over into Indonesia, or into China, then Indonesia, the Pacific, Eastern Europe, and soon the entire world. And what was our media always had a great deal of difficulty, our political elites did, sort of making sense of the fact that during the same time they would be talking about the domino theory and this communist monolith, both China and the Soviet Union were embroiled in, you know, came to war in the 1960s briefly, and then had a very antagonistic relationship, at least the two people were supposed to be scared of. And then later, China had very antagonistic relations with Vietnam in a war situation again. So it's a much more complex situation politically than we've been able to sort of grope with. And as you talk about now, we see with the rise of sort of market relations in China, a real mixed attitude. It's no longer the evil empire, this terrible place that's trying to take over the world, but neither is it fully embraced either. It's sort of there's what do you think accounts for that among our elite press? Why is there this sort of mixed attitude?
I think it's a very complex process. I mean, as you yourself were just suggesting, but on the one hand, there's a colossal amount of foreign investment going into China, including significantly, maybe most significantly, Professor Zhao would know better than I on this, U.S. foreign investment. So we're talking here, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year going into China to produce all kinds of goods using the cheap labor that's available in China, and that U.S. business people are only too happy to try to get access to. On the other hand, as we were saying, there still is a significant current of opinion and activity in China that is committed to socialist principles, so that's a source of great uncertainty on the part of these same elites. They can't live without it, and they can't live with it. Mm-hmm. And so you get this almost schizophrenic quality. And then you have also competing political allegiances as well, so that the historical commitment of the Republican Party in particular to Taiwan, as opposed to the People's Republic of China, has generated, particularly in the more conservative press, the Wall Street Journal, for example, a continuing concern that we must not lose that commitment to Taiwan, mm-hmm. no matter what.
Mm-hmm. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today in WILL 580. My guests are Dan Schiller, a professor here at the University of Illinois, and Professor Yuzi Zhao, visiting us today from Vancouver, Canada, giving a guest lecture in the community. And therefore, this is a tape show. We aren't accepting calls. Professor Zhao, the changes that have taken place in China in the last 20 years, are they popular? What has been the response of the population? They've been embraced, rejected, a combination? How would you describe the sort of social acceptance and participation in the changes in China in the last 20 years?
It really depends on which segment of the population you are talking about, also at different at which point. Because in the beginning, I would argue that is in the late 70s, early 80s, I would argue that there is almost a kind of broad popular support for the economic reforms. But in the early 80s, the reform can be called as a kind of a process where almost everybody is a winner. But by the late 80s, and especially since the early 90s, the reform actually generates a clear class of winners and losers. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, you have the urban middle class who are very well integrated into the new economy and into the global system. So who are the beneficiaries in many ways? At the same time, you have massive layoff of state enterprise workers as part of the process to make state enterprises more efficient. And also you have basically massive dislocation of the Chinese peasantry. So by the late 90s, it's very clear that you have major social stratification. So the support for reform, well, it depends on what you define as reform, really, has been more different.
So if I can get a handle on some figures, when you talk about the sort of middle class, the urban middle class, it's benefiting by the marketization and this increase in inequality because they're the ones who are at the top end of that spread and inequality. We're talking about maybe 5 or 10% of the population at most. I mean, just or 20. I mean, what? Just get a general sense of, you know, how the split is. Is that accurate, roughly?
Yes, I would put between. It really depends on whose statistics.
Yeah.
Some argue that right now, the middle class consists about between 10 to 15% of the working population. Mm-hmm. That translates into about 100 million.
Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty healthy size middle class.
Right, and that itself is a huge, in absolute terms, a huge population. Yeah.
But then that also means the other 80, 85%, you're looking at several hundred million people who aren't participating and whose quality of life is deteriorating.
Right, or relatively deprived, as
relatively
I would say.
Deprived.
And others actually, yes, in more absolute poverty.
And periodically we hear of strikes and demonstrations. It doesn't get a great deal of coverage in the Western media.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, it sounds like there's more social upheaval in the country than there's been in quite a long time, since the 1960s, perhaps.
Yes, definitely. Actually, even the party itself was saying that this is going to be a period of labor unrest. And in the past few years, or actually throughout the 90s, there have been tens of thousands of farmers' uprisings, refusing paying taxes or kind of excessive taxes, workers, especially laid-off workers, pensioners, demanding a better economic deal, basically.
The other story that comes out and about China, and this is really true, and Dan, you can talk about this too, about all over the world that goes through these market-type reforms, is that apparently there's a spectacular amount of corruption that goes on in the governing process as contracts are given to private businesses. Can you talk a little bit about this, Professor Zhao?
Yes. Actually, the whole entire reform process is a process of corruption, and which is defined as basically unauthorized, illegal transfer of wealth, public wealth previously into private hands. So kind of illegal privatization of state assets, all those. And if you recall, actually, in 1989, one of the main reasons for the massive protest is rampant government corruption. And actually, the population demand an end to that, or at least measures to counter that. But actually, with the suppression of that a popular uprising, in the 90s, corruption became part of way of life, part of the way the business is done in China.
You know, sometimes I've seen stories where they'll talk about foreign ventures going into China, media specifically, but I think it's true across the board, where they seem to sort of cut in the children of party officials and give them shares of the ownership, making instant millionaires in these enterprises. And the only thing they're providing is sort of access to the politicians. Is that a common phenomenon?
Yes, it is very common, not only throughout the economic sectors, in media too, actually. Mm-hmm. And also right now, actually, some of the scandals, biggest scandals, involves the media. One recent, for example, one case involves corruption at the top level of the party's leading newspaper conglomerate in Guangzhou, actually. Yeah.
And this is where the party figures get ownership stakes in it, or?
Well, not ownership stakes as such, but just, you know, basically private use of public assets.
I see.
So they basically, for example, in the case of Guangzhou, you have the executives of the newspaper conglomerate use public money for their own private gains and will travel abroad, all of that kind of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, Dan Schiller, you study this process of market deregulation or market spread of market regulation all over the world in telecommunications and media systems. And the promise of these sort of turns to the so-called free market is that it will get rid of corruption, that it will bring in the fairness of the market. Whoever produces the most at the best price most efficiently wins, you know, as Milton Friedman instructs us. Yet the experience in China seems to suggest that at least so far in China, this turn to the market has unleashed a rampant wave of corruption. In fact, I don't think there's any dispute about that. That's commonly accepted in the business process. Just a cost of doing business in China is you have to cut in the party officials a big chunk of the action. Is that true in other countries, or is China the exception?
I think it's true all over the world. I think China may be an extreme case, although perhaps it's just that we're getting somewhat more intensive coverage than we might be in some other countries that matter less, as you pointed out earlier, in the greater scheme of things to the global political economy.
You know, why does China counsel? Why is China so important? Maybe give our listeners a sense of what is so appealing about the Chinese market from the vantage point of American companies or global companies.
Well, my sense is, and I'll defer to Professor Zhao on this, but my sense is that you could look at it both from the point of view of consumption and from the point of view of production. From the point of view of consumption, as you were mentioning, there is a very substantial middle class that has come into existence. And let me just say about that for a moment. When we were just in Beijing, I went as a novice. I'd never been to China before. What was staggering as you went through the city of Beijing, or at least those large parts of it that we drove through over the course of several days, was the scope and extent of the middle-class commercial districts, which are almost indistinguishable in many ways from those that you would find in Chicago or New York.
So all the same logos and chains and franchises?
A lot of the same logos. You can go to McDonald's, Starbucks, Kentucky Fried Chicken. They're all active and evident there. But I'm not speaking so much just about American-based companies, rather about the style of middle-class consumption, whoever presides over it in terms of which companies we're speaking of. It's vast and very unexpected, even to someone who tries to pay attention to the newspaper reports of the transformation that's ongoing there. Mm-hmm. So that's on the consumption side. There's 300 million conservatively television households in China. 300 million. That makes it...
That's the size of all of Europe's TV market, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, that's, as you well know, Bob, yes, it's the largest domestic TV market in the world in terms of the number of households that are able to watch TV. So on the consumption side, there's tremendous interest on China as the next biggest frontier of market development. On the production side, there is, if anything, even more intense interest because of the availability of basically innumerable cheap laborers. You can have access to as much cheap labor as you desire. If you are a transnational company and find it possible to invest in China to gain access to the labor force. So on both sides, there is a fantastic interest generated all over the market, the advanced market economies, in gaining access to China, either to produce things or to sell things or both.
You just got back from China, you said. Were you surprised by what you saw there? What did you learn that surprised you when you were there? What did you expect and what did you find?
I went with only murky expectations, partly because, you know, you read the paper a lot and you get murkier expectations. You're not necessarily clear on everything you're going to be waiting to see there. And so I went thinking I would find evidence of a lot of poverty and, on the other hand, probably some wealth. But I was utterly unprepared for the scale of the wealth, the scale of the commercialization. When people mention these figures about, $40, $50 billion a year in foreign direct investment in China, you see the evidence of that in Beijing in the context of really not just dozens, but even hundreds of office buildings and commercial emporia that mall-type structures and so forth that are just all new. And you see derricks everywhere as concrete is being poured and buildings are going up. You see it everywhere. The other thing that you see, which was a tremendous surprise in a certain sense, though it makes great sense. We went to a department store to pick up a few things just to bring back as gifts. And the major difference that was evident between a department store in Beijing, or at least the one that we went into, and the comparable store in the United States, whether it would be maybe, well, I won't mention any brands, but a department store here, was that there was more than abundant labor.
Mm-hmm.
Here, you have to go and almost try to claw away a salesperson to get you rung up.
Mm-hmm.
To find help, you know, can you please tell me, do you have this item in the size I need? Where we were in Beijing, there were people everywhere waiting to help.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure whether to attribute that to the cheapness of labor or to the commitment to some sort of higher level of service or to residual sorts of features of the non-market economy there, or some combination of those factors.
I'd take striking A if it's a multiple choice test.
I'm
Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Today we're talking about China, media in China, and the general political economy of China. It sets the context that the media operate within. Our guests are Professor Dan Schiller, a colleague of mine here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Dan formerly taught at the University of California at San Diego. This is his first year in Urbana. We're glad to have him here. He's also in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, as well as the Institute for Communication Research. Our other guest, our honored guest, is Professor Yuzi Zhao, who is from China originally, but now lives in Vancouver, British Columbia, where she's a professor in the Department of Communication at Simon Fraser University. And this is a tape program, so we're not taking calls today, so please don't call in, because we're doing this program shortly before we go on air while Professor Zhao is in town so we can talk about these issues with her. And Professor Zhao, one of the things I think our listeners should know about you, what makes your analysis of China so important, is that you were also an expert on journalism in North America. You co-authored a book with one of the leading Canadian scholars, Robert Hackett, on the development of objectivity and journalism in the North American context. So what you can bring to China, to the analysis of Chinese media, is a much richer understanding of how market relations affect the content of journalism than probably someone who's just coming out of the Chinese context, who's been experiencing the market as a break from the state. I mean, is there a tendency, and this is sort of a rhetorical question, but is there a tendency among people in China who haven't had the experience you've had to sort of not understand that when you get away from state control of media, there are also strings attached to market control?
Yes, I definitely agree with you. Actually, my study of North American media, especially market itself as a form of regulation, really informed my understanding of the media in China. And that's what I would say why my book is different from many other analyses of the media in China. Most people do come in, as you're saying, that to assume that once the Chinese media is commercialized, then openness and democratization will follow. But in fact, in the case of China right now, state control and actually market bias really goes very well, because the state itself right now is trying to, as I mentioned earlier about the bias of the reform, the state itself is really appeasing to the interests of the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the market-driven media, because of the structural biases, also tend to cater to the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, these two actually works together very well.
Yeah, China's a nation of 1.2 billion people. I mean, it's an enormous country. It must have a massive amount of media in the country. Can you give us as a thumbnail sketch of just what the nature of the media experience would be in China? What sort of system is there? How many newspapers? You know, how prevalent is television?
Right. Television is truly a mass medium. It reached a huge population, both in the rural areas, in the countryside. Right now, the penetration rate is 106 television sets per 100 household, which is pretty extensive.
Boy, that's reaching serious TV
junkie. Yeah.
Couch sales gone up too. That's incredible.
Yes, and actually, yes, you talk about more than 300 million television sets. So even in the countryside, television is truly a mass medium. And in this case, you have some of the consumers might not be big spenders, but you have a huge number.
Now, when we were talking before, just to interrupt on this issue. you know, you talked about how it's several hundred million people who are clearly losing out in the sort of the market reforms. They're losing jobs. They might be unemployed. They're very poor. Are the poorest people in the countryside or in the cities, are they watching TV too?
Yes, they watch TV too.
So it's truly a mass medium.
Truly a mass medium. But in the case of print media, the situation is a little bit different. Right now you have more about over 2,000 newspapers. And many of the newspapers were concentrating in urban areas. So although in the past 20 years, the size of the press has grown quite a bit, but overall what you have is basically a stratification of the press. So an interesting figure here is while the number of newspapers grew by almost 10 times over the past 20 years, the actual size of the press, that is measured by how many issues of newspaper published, grow actually by 2 times.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So what you have is basically a more kind of a fragmentation of the newspaper market.
Uh-huh.
So what you have is more newspapers catering to the urban middle class.
Mm-hmm.
You can get anything you want, from specialized stock market reports to specialized consumer papers.
Now, in the olden days, before the reforms in China, the market reforms, the media were controlled by the party and subsidized by the party, so right?
Right.
Were they all strictly party-owned, or did the government own some? I mean, how was the media system structured before the reforms, the newspapers specifically?
Yeah, with regard to the newspapers before the reform is, yes, it's totally state-controlled, but also state-subsidized.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have advertising at mm-hmm. all.
And that's the key. As your book points out, I think it's quite wonderfully, the shift to have to be self-supporting and
right.
return to advertising really is the decisive move in the Chinese press and
yes,
media.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. And with advertising support, what you see is newspapers that cater to the middle-class consumers were flourishing, especially urban newspapers. At the same time, newspapers that cater to other groups like workers, women, were struggling because they cannot get advertising revenue
yeah.
because they were not ideal advertising vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see a clear trend. On the one hand, newspapers catering to consumer needs proliferated.
Mm-hmm.
The party organs end up publishing market-oriented subsidiaries. On the other hand, a newspaper that cater to workers, for example, in the case right now, the Workers' Daily, which itself is not really a independent voice for the workers, but still sometimes it addresses workers' concerns,
mm-hmm.
and that paper has been struggling, can't survive.
No, the papers are still state-owned, but they don't get any subsidy from the state.
No, they don't get any subsidy.
So they have a lot of autonomy then. They have to raise their own money through advertising and through selling the paper, subscriptions, I guess, or street sales.
Right.
And then, but they have a lot of editorial autonomy. How much censorship is there? Let's say you're the editor of the Workers Daily.
Mm-hmm.
Can you write an article about the government and say it's corrupt and sleazy? Or what happens to you if you do that?
Definitely not. You can't.
That'd be the end of your career?
Right. End of your career, end of your paper, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And there are situations over the past 10 years, especially newspaper closures or reorganization or kind of things. So party control remains. Actually, sometimes I will argue that it was strengthened.
Mm-hmm.
So all kind of, you know, the jail of journalists still happens. The closure of newspapers still often used as a means of control.
Mm-hmm.
And also you have just kind of regular party directions.
Mm-hmm.
On this issue, you cannot say this. On that issue, you cannot say that.
Explicitly.
Right. Very explicit propaganda, what is called, you know, party lines.
Really? They really
lay out. For example, I mentioned earlier about, you know, tens of thousands of workers' protests or peasant uprisings. None of this happened as far as the Chinese media are concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Simply said, no reporting whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So very clear party propaganda directives.
I guess the real sign of the system working, so they don't have to give directives anymore, when the values are internalized to the extent that you don't need to be told what to do. Is that starting where smart editors just sort of learn,
yes,
this is the wise thing not to cover?
Right, definitely. And also nowadays, especially with commercial support, there's an imperative, actually, for these editors not to offend the party. Mm-hmm. Because so long as you don't offend the party, they can, you can do very well in your business. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, with the cut of state subsidies, most of the editors are depending on the market for their own basic salary.
Well, what's the incentive of the editor? If they don't own the paper, you know, they're not getting a profit like Rupert Murdoch gets if he owns the New York Post, for example. You know, why are they so obsessed with commercialism? Why wouldn't they just say, okay, I'll do a little bit of this, but I'm really here to be a journalist. I'm really here to write. What's in it for them to get so concerned with commercialism and buy into those values if they don't own it?
Mm-hmm. That is a very good question, actually. What happened, my thinking is that many of these editors themselves are part of the middle class, the beneficiaries of the reforms. And some of them actually truly believe in the market. Mm-hmm. They believe in this idea of consumer sovereignty. They mm-hmm. believe that by catering to the market, they are speaking for the people.
And ultimately produce the best possible
results. Right, ultimately produce the best possible results. On the other hand, there are economic incentives as well. Yes, you know, they're not using the poverty papers to generate personal profit as such, like Rupert Murdoch, but their salaries, their livelihood are dependent upon the profitable operation of media.
Are they going to let capitalist media come into China, do you think? Is that on the horizon? Will they let, in newspapers and broadcasting, let private companies come in and try to maximize profit like in the United States?
Right now, I don't see the immediate possibility of a private ownership of the media. Because the party is still quite wary of that. But there are, yes, many private businesses ready to enter the newspaper market. And gradually, what's possible is probably that the party will try to allow, actually, there's already some openness, allow private, or at least state-run capital or state capital to enter the media.
So state-run businesses for profit.
Right, yes, yeah.
We're talking with Yu Zhi Zhao, the professor from Simon Fraser University. She's our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our other guest is Dan Schiller, a professor here at the University of Illinois. And today we're talking about the media in China, the changes in China. Professor Zhao is the leading expert on that subject in North America, if not the world. And Dan Schiller just returned from China. He's an expert in international communication. Dan, did you get a chance to watch television while you were in Beijing?
The only television that I was able to see, Bob, was CNN.
Really?
I saw CNN International. Now, that's not because I couldn't have looked at other channels, but because I was not able to have access to the international press. There was no International Herald Tribune, no Wall Street Journal for sale, no Financial Times.
Is that the pattern there, or is it just a bad day? Or, I mean, are they normally for sale in Beijing?
Well, it depends in which hotel you stay. In some of the 4-star, 5-star hotels, actually, they do sell a limited number of foreign newspapers, including the ones then
mentioned.
Even
the business press is limited. I'm surprised. I would have thought, frankly, that you'd have seen the business press more prevalent in Beijing.
So to go back to your question, I felt because of the press of world events these days a very great urgency about having some access to things I could make sense of, and I didn't have too much time to pay attention to anything other than the business at hand at our conference. So I basically watched CNN International and became more aware of the way to which they are localizing their production operations.
Mm-hmm. You know, the reason I ask is that we have a grocer here in Urbana that I go to. It's just a couple blocks from our house, the Sunshine Grocery. Dan's probably familiar with it. And they have a TV on, and they have a satellite. So they get the CCTV, the Chinese main television network. And I watch it periodically while I'm shopping. And what's astonishing to me is the production values are so high. I mean, you really think, I mean, I was expecting, if someone said Chinese television, because I'll tell you, when I went to Europe in the mid-80s, my wife's Norwegian. Sometimes we'd see like East German or Bulgarian shows on public television, and it'd always be these like the lamest shows about tractors, and they would be the production values would be very low. And I assumed that Chinese media is going to be the same thing, but instead it was the highest quality production values. I mean, it was just like watching an American commercial program, except it was Chinese. I mean, is that the pattern? Would you say, Professor Zhao?
Yes, actually, throughout the 90s, since the 80s, the party actually put a lot of effort into improving what they call the production value of the media system, especially television. Mm-hmm. They really learned a lot in terms of the techniques from Western television. And you are right. You can't really tell Chinese from the Western commercial television, except for the Chinese language.
There's no way you could watch what I've watched and say, hey, that's a communist country. That's an anti-capitalist country. I mean, there's just absolutely no way. I thought originally it was like from Taiwan or something. Then they said, no, this is the main television channel in China. I went, whoa, the things have changed in China. Now, another thing about China, this gets to the point you were raising earlier, Dan, is that it's such a huge market, and getting access to that television market must be such a plum to the big TV producers of the world, the Disneys, the AOL, Time Warners, the Sonys. They must be chomping at the bit to get into this market. Is there a lot of activity by companies like Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation to try to get into this television market?
Yes, this has been a relentless effort, actually, even from the 80s. And recently, there has been some major breakthroughs. Of course, the leading company in this regard is Rupert Murdoch's Star TV. Based in Hong Kong. Right now, actually, or even from the for many years, Star TV had a joint venture with a Chinese businessman, very well connected with the Chinese leadership. They set up this satellite television called Phoenix TV. Mm-hmm. It reaches a wide audience or elite audience in China.
It's carried on cable TV systems, or is it broadcast over the air?
It was broadcast over the air. Officially, was supposed to be illegal. But if you live in hotels, apartments, luxury apartments, or live in government compounds, you're able to receive it. Mm-hmm. And actually, Phoenix TV claimed that by the late 90s, have about 15.9% of the Chinese television households.
That's a lot of households.
And yes, a lot of households, and these are no ordinary households. They are, according to one advertising executive, you know, the Phoenix audience is characterized by three high, one low. High by official status, high by educational level, by income, and one low in terms of low age. So this is an ideal audience.
Now, when Rupert Murdoch, who owns News Corporation, which in the United States owns Fox Television, Fox 20th Century Fox Pictures, the Los Angeles Dodgers, book publishers, HarperCollins, and a host of other things. When they go to a country like China with their Star television service, are they trying to peddle reruns of Gilligan's Island and X-Files and pro wrestling? What sort of programming are they offering to Chinese viewers?
I think they go through a learning curve, basically. Originally, they tried to do that, but it really doesn't work. So they tried to localize. Mm-hmm. In the case of Phoenix TV, for example, they really rely on the Chinese personnel to produce the shows. So they cater their content to the local audience. Mm-hmm. There are some reruns, Western American or other soap operas, that kind of thing. But overall, their content is very localized.
They found out that the Gilligan's Island and She's the Sheriff, those sort of shows just aren't that popular with the Chinese viewers. Is that the case?
Right.
How about the journalism that Phoenix is providing? Oftentimes media corporations in this country love to pat themselves on the back and congratulate themselves for their adversarial role towards the government. And they use that as a justification for the tremendous privileges they receive as businesses and the profits they earn. Are the Rupert Murdoch taking those same values he claims here and going into China and doing some pretty hard investigative work on how power operates in China?
No, definitely not. Actually, Phoenix journalism is very, very mild, and actually it really doesn't deal with any investigative stories at all. Of course, it will stay away from criticizing Chinese leadership as a matter of principle, basically.
I mean, so it's not more critical than the Chinese Communist Party press would be toward the leadership, would you say, or is it roughly the same?
I would say even less critical. For example, some of the local newspapers or some of the investigative stories that local papers will carry.
Really? That's quite striking. In fact, I saw a story, I don't know if it's true, I wrote it, so it better be, I have my citation for it, that when Phoenix News' news correspondent interviewed the head of state in China, his first comment was, "You are my hero."
Yes, she is a women anchor. Yes. You are my hero. And it was a laughing stock among the Hong Kong journalists. Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite a statement. That must have been a hard-hitting interview.
Yes, it is.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters Today on WILL 580. My guest, who you've been listening to just now, is Professor Yuzi Zhao from Simon Fraser University in Canada, a native of China, and an expert on Chinese media, and also an expert on North American media, which I think informs her analysis. Also in the studio with us is my colleague, Professor Dan Schiller, professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science, as well as the Institute of Communications Research. Dan is an expert on international telecommunications and media policy, and he recently went to China, came back, and has seen it. What's going to happen in China? What do you see? You know, this is such an important place. Media seem to be right at the center of all these changes, sort of the epicenter of the rise of the market, but still having sort of Communist Party authority. Where is this heading, Professor Zhao? I mean, what can you, if you had to look into a crystal ball, what's with these pressures percolating? Do you have any sense of what's going on there in the future?
Well, to predict the future of China, I think it's the riskiest business. But what I can say is I can outline some of the major social forces that are underlying the current situation. Right now, the party really is relying on the middle class to sustain its role, and it tries very hard. It tries very hard to appease to this middle class by providing all kind of consumer goods, by trying to incorporate them into the power strata. For example, the Chinese party, General Party Secretary Jiang Zemin, last year made major announcement that, you know, capitalist professionals, business managers will be allowed into the party. So there is a major process of incorporation going on. But I would argue that actually the Chinese middle class is right now pretty optimistic. Mm-hmm. If in case there's a major economic slowdown, a crisis in the stock market, that kind of thing, I don't think the party can rely upon the middle class for continued support. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, social unrest were spreading, and over the past decade, you can see an acceleration of protests. For example, workers' protests have spread to many more cities. Their scale of operation and the duration of their protests were really visible these days.
I want to interrupt just for a second because that really touches an interesting point. In 1989, during the Tiananmen Square uprising, one issue that got a lot of attention was how the dissidents and the radicals were able to circumvent, make an end run around the Chinese media and communication systems using new technologies, the internet, fax machines, CB radio, whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that happening with the dissident forces now, the workers? Are they finding ways to get around the existing commercial and state media to communicate and organize?
Well, I think there are differences. In 89, yes, the middle class, the intellectuals, the university students, they are very well connected internationally, domestically. But right now, the main protagonists of the Chinese social movements were not as good or as fully equipped as the dissidents in 89. So their communication is very much blocked by the current communication system. For example, in 89, one of the major features is actually that mainstream journalists were very sympathetic towards the movement. And
In Beijing,
during that window of opportunity when the party's control system really basically paralyzed, the media provide major sympathetic coverage of the movement that helped spread the movement, legitimize the movement. Nowadays, there's no coverage whatsoever about workers' protests. So these kind of protests remain isolated, localized.
Oftentimes we hear about, in this country, it's a widespread phenomenon, the idea that the internet is going to be this magic elixir which will sort of set people free so they won't have to rely upon dominant state or commercial media and communicate with each other. How is the internet affecting China? What sort of role is it playing? Does it hold that sort of promise to sort of undercut the sort of top-down commercial and governmental media machine?
Right. Right now, what happens, the internet reaches about 3% of the population. And the situation is like this. On the one hand, yes, there is quite a lot of activity going on the internet, and there's more relative freedom on the internet compared with the mainstream media. But the groups that have access to the internet are not necessarily the groups that has the most grievances against the party or mm-hmm. against the state. So yes, you know, these people can use the internet to communicate for themselves, but they're not on the forefront of organizing against the party state.
Is the government doing anything to try to stop the internet from having the effect it could potentially have? Is it monitoring it? I mean, how's the government responding to the internet?
Oh, yes. Yeah, there are all kinds of monitoring activities. On the structural level, the party has issued many very restrictive regulations, try to maintain control over the internet. And also at the same time, you know, the party installed something like a very tight, what some call, you know, the Great Chinese Firewalls mm-hmm. to basically prevent access to certain internet websites. Mm-hmm. They also establish what is called the internet police, mm-hmm. Cyber police, to monitor internet activities. There are also what's called Big Mama, basically supervisors over internet chat rooms.
Really? So they're taking it very seriously.
Oh, yes, very seriously. Yeah. They have filter systems, software that can spot certain words, say, June 4th, democracy, all kind of things. So it's a multi-layered system of control from the very structure, the setup of the internet to the actual online activities.
Yeah. Now, Dan Schiller, you have studied more than anyone I know telecommunications around the world, what's taking place with the liberalization, the use of market control over telecommunications, by which we mean basically telephone systems traditionally. And these telephone systems that have been privatized all across the world and in China or commercialized are sort of the backbone oftentimes for the internet. I mean, is there a problem here? And these companies are coming in, they want to make a lot of money providing services, and internet services are one of their core services. And then they have the government that's freaking out because they're afraid of what it might allow people to communicate in ways they don't want. Is this a tension in China today, Dan?
Well, I'm not as knowledgeable about some of these things as Professor Zhao, but I think that the general effort now intensifying all over the world with the current slowdown, as they call it, or slump, as we might really more adequately say in telecommunications, is to do anything to stimulate demand. Mm-hmm. There is a tremendous effort everywhere in the United States, in Europe, and I would guess also on the part of some of the providers in China to try to stimulate demand to alleviate the economic slump that has hit the telecommunications industry by generating new kinds of traffic, if possible, using a lot of what they call bandwidth or information carrying capacity, mm-hmm. video, high-speed data, and so forth. So in a general sense, yes, I think there would be a tension there. But how it's expressed in the context where the major objective of the telecommunications companies like the media conglomerates is to make some sort of rapprochement with the Chinese authorities to mm-hmm. make sure they can have continued unbroken access to what they hope will be an expanding market, mm-hmm. Perhaps this takes secondary importance compared to that primary goal.
Well, let's turn to Professor Zhao to find out the answer. What is going on in China with telecommunications? How is it changing, and what are some of the debates going on there?
Yeah, right now there has been major push for the liberalization of the telecommunications system.
And liberalization meaning private owners, private investors, private search for profit, ruling decision-making process.
Right. Not just private ownership as such, but right now is just the introduction of market mechanism into the Chinese telecommunication market. In the past few years, you have seen twice the Chinese telecommunication monopoly, China Telecom, was being broken up. First, China Telecom was broken up among its service lines. So you have separation of mobile phone operations from fixed line operations. Mm-hmm. And right now, the process is still going on. You have the breakup, once again, China Telecom along geographic lines. The purpose is to introducing competition, in this case, competition between state-owned mm-hmm. Telecommunication operations. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was this competition that created a massive market, for example, in the case of mobile phone. Mm-hmm. And right now, the key process that's going on is to reorganize the Chinese telecommunication system in such a way that domestic companies will be prepared to receive foreign investment mm-hmm. as a result of China's term
closely linked to sort of the turn to the global market, this privatization or at least liberalization of telecommunications.
Yeah.
You know, that we only have about 5 or 6 minutes left on our show today, and I just want to remind listeners that today's Media Matters with Professor Yuzi Zhao and Dan Schiller is being pre-recorded while Professor Zhao is visiting us in town so that we aren't taking phone calls. But really, in the final few minutes, what I'd like to talk about is exactly that issue, which is as these trade deals are being negotiated at the global level, the entry, for example, of China into the World Trade Organization, or the most favored nation trading status of China, which is the United States, it seems like telecommunications and other media issues then emerge, become very prominent, a very significant bargaining area. Could you talk a little bit about that, please, Professor Zhao? Is this something you've been looking at and studying?
Yes, that has been something that I've been studying. Telecommunications is a major area in the U.S.-China WTO agreement and the entire WTO package.
And making it a liberalized system,
liberalized
taking it out of the
system,
state hand.
Right. Introduce the market mechanism and take out of the state's hand. And actually, the Chinese state itself is pushing for this. Mm-hmm. Again, part out of this liberal conviction that the market is the most efficient means of providing services. Mm-hmm.
Keep that thought for a second. I want to ask Dan Schiller, because I know you study this left hand around the world and in the United States. That conviction that the market is the best provider of telecommunication services, is that true?
Well, in the sense that it provides access for those who can pay to a basket of services that's never been seen before, yes.
So for businesses in China?
For businesses in China, and Bob, you're raising an absolutely critical point here because the number of businesses that are coming into China as foreign direct investors is growing astronomically. And so as a key feature, not only of their ordinary business practices around the rest of the world, but now in China as well, not least because of the provisions of the World Trade Organization agreements, they are hoping to gain access to comparable telecommunication services. They need them for the most prosaic but necessary kinds of functions, mm-hmm. from inventory to accounting to other managerial and supervisory functions. Mm-hmm. And they're absolutely bound up, as they are in the rest of the world, with these kinds of business processes.
Who loses out, though, when you do that?
Well, when you have a market-based telecommunications system such as the one we now have also developed in the United States, you find that the more liberalized sectors of the market, for example, wireless, suffer from inadequacies that were not common in the previous wireline system, as no less an authority than the Wall Street Journal pointed out yesterday in a major article.
And so the losers are then the average people, I mean, who don't buy these fancy services, who aren't don't need exotic.
Well, it's a straight tiered system. If
okay.
you have access to resources, you can have access to information and telecommunications, the likes of which only a king could dream of.
And that's where the
past.
Profits are for these companies.
And that's where the profits are.
Okay.
If you're an ordinary person, the level of service that you enjoy is much less adequate.
Okay. And this is a key part, Professor Zhao, again, this is a key part of these deals that are being negotiated by the United States and the WTO with China and seem to be closely wrapped up with the whole evolution of the Chinese political economy. Is there opposition to these deals in China, or is it basically unanimous? This is a great thing.
Well, yes, definitely there is opposition. And the thing is right now in China, you don't see that in the Chinese press.
Mm-hmm.
The voices of those people who are opposing or who have doubts about all these trade deals were basically suppressed. And actually, the Chinese population were not even informed of the basic provisions of these trade deals.
That sounds like the United States population in these deals, too. It's a close parallel there.
Right, yes, in that sense. And I definitely agree with what Dan is saying about who will be the losers. Actually, mm-hmm. over the past 20 years, for example, the Chinese telecommunication system has expanded tremendously, but now it's reaching a critical point. Already you have the business press, the overall, yes, urban newspapers. We're talking about, you know, the telecommunication system now, it's unsustainable. It should not reach those low-end users. They have become a business liability. They were already talking about, you know, those poor people in the countryside, they are not good customers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a drain on the system. So yeah. So it's China's entire media system, telecommunication system is at a critical point.
You know, I want to thank you very much, Professor Zhao, for being my guest today on Media Matters. I'd like to thank you too, Dan Schiller, for coming into the studio and helping us understand this part of the world. It's clear that this is an area we're going to have to keep our eyes on. It's an area of turbulence of tremendous importance for all of us, and that we're going to keep stay on top of here in Media Matters. My name is Bob McChesney. We'll be back next week with another show. Thank you all.